Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
We have another special guest with us today. And on the line, we have Abdu Murray. Welcome to the podcast, Abdu.
Great to be with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Abdu Murray is a North American director with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries and is the author of three books, including his latest, Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. For most of his life, Abdu was a proud Muslim who studied the Quran and Islam. After a nine-year investigation into the historical, philosophical, and scientific underpinnings of the major world religions and views, Abdu discovered the historic Christian faith and committed his life to Christ. Abdu holds a BA in psychology from the University of Michigan and earned his Juris Doctor from the University of Michigan Law School and went on to practice law as a business litigation attorney. Yeah, Abdu, would you? I think people would be interested to hear a little bit of a brief story of your conversion. Would you be able to do that for us?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Most of my life, I was a Shiite Muslim. The real way to say it is Shia, but most folks say Shiite. There are two divisions within Islam, main divisions, actually quite a few divisions, but the main divisions are the Sunni, which are the majority, and the Shia, which are the minority. And the basic beliefs are the same, but there are some practical differences. But I was a pretty committed Muslim and wanted people to believe Islam and had engaged in conversations with folks whenever I could about why Islam was true and whatever their worldview was, because I was an equal opportunity faith knocker, outer upper. It was an equal opportunity thing. So if you were a Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, Jew, atheist, whatever, or a Christian, I spoke to you about why you were wrong and I was right. But I did it in conversations and I tried to be nice about it. Over the course of some time, though, I came across some Christians. There weren't many of them, but there were a few, a blessed few, who actually knew how to respond to my objections, and they also had some objections of their own to me. So I took it pretty seriously, and I wanted to make sure I understood the Christian faith so that I could respond to these Christians. And a funny thing happened on the way to the mosque, as they say, and I found that the answers for the gospel, the credibility was mounting. And it was becoming what one person has called an inconvenient truth, that not only is the gospel, as we have it in the Bible, actually accurately preserved down through the centuries, but in that accurately preserved word, it actually conforms to history as we know it. And that history includes that Jesus claimed to be the Son of God, who takes away the sins of the world, and then he died as a matter of history, but he rose again as a matter of history to prove he was right. All this, of course, was shattering to a Muslim worldview, which rejects all those things. It rejects the Trinity. It rejects the incarnation of God in Christ, and it rejects the atonement and, of course, the resurrection that follows. So I had to deal with that because the consequences of embracing that truth were various and serious, but not the least of which, actually, was the change of my identity, who I was going to be. I liked being a Muslim. I was very happy being a Muslim, and if the gospel was true, then I always thought to myself, who would I be if I became this Christian? Well, it took 9 years to become a Christian, and the reason wasn't because it was hard to find the answers, but it was hard to accept the answers, because my preference was that Islam was true, but the reality was is that Christianity was proving itself more and more true to me, and I had to come to grips with that reality. And when I did, I finally saw that all the things that I was wishing were true about God in my former worldview were actually true about God in the Christian worldview, that God is incomparably great, and that I can have not only a worship of a God who is great, but fulfillment in that worship, not merely as master to slave, but as someone who can have an intimate knowledge of who God is, and that God stepped into history and actually did something about my sin, not just said something about my sin. That fulfilled me intellectually, emotionally, and existentially. And when that happened, I gave my life to Christ.
Wow, that's great. Thank you for sharing that. We are here today to talk about your newest book, Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. In 2016, the Oxford English Dictionaries named the word of the year to be post-truth. How is the word post-truth being defined in our present cultural context? And how should we define truth itself?
Yeah, that's both great questions. So a post-truth culture, according to the dictionary, is one that actually elevates preferences and feelings above facts and truth. So it's not exactly a postmodern culture. Postmodernism is different. Postmodernism said that there are no objective truths. All truth claims are relative to our perspectives and our experiences, and any attempt to foist an objective truth onto us is a power move, and we have to get rid of those power moves and embrace a non-objective or a purely subjective view of the truth. But of course, you can argue with someone like that. You can say, look, you say there are no objective truths, then that statement's either objectively true or it's subjectively true. And if it's objectively true, then it's self-defeating. If it's subjectively true, then who cares? What you said, in a sense, said nothing. So you can actually argue with someone like that. But a post-truth culture is different. They don't deny objective truths exist. They simply subordinate them to their preferences. In other words, what they say is objective truths exist, and if they conflict with my preferences, then I don't care. And that's a little bit more difficult to actually deal with. So that's how I think we define it in our culture. But the truth itself, someone asked me this recently on Twitter, how do you define truth, in response to some tweets that I had made about the post-truth culture. And my answer is, I don't get to define truth. Truth is simply a word we use to describe that which conforms to reality. So you have propositional truths, you have historical truths, you have scientific truths. All these things are truth, but it's because they conform to reality. And if it doesn't conform to reality, then it's not true.
In your first chapter, you talk about the culture of confusion, and then you also talk about the soft and hard modes of post-truth. Could you talk about that and define that for us?
Sure, absolutely. So the culture of confusion, I think, falls in line with what a post-truth culture actually is. If we recall that a post-truth culture is one that elevates preferences and feelings over facts and truth, then you're naturally going to lead into a culture of confusion. And what that culture is it's one that values confusion as a virtue, but decries clarity as a sin. And we've seen this time and time again. I mean, we think about it. If you're confused sexually, whether it's regard to same-sex attractions or this new phrase, this pansexualism, where we have no sexual boundaries, or you have some kind of confusion in your life, that's considered heroic or brave. If you're confused morally, where there are no objective morals, it's all subjective, and we can sort of determine morality as situationally, well, that confusion is considered progressive. And if you're confused religiously, you know, no one worldview has a lock on truth, or they're all equally valid, or some would say equally invalid, well, that confusion is equated with tolerance. So confusion sexually is heroic, confusion morally is progressive, and confusion religiously is tolerant. But if you're clear on boundaries of sexuality, especially if you're clear based on the Bible's definitions of what sexuality should be, well, that's considered bigoted. If you're clear on moral boundaries, well, that's considered regressive. And if you're clear that there is a verifiable single way to heaven or to God, well, that's considered intolerant. So confusion is a virtue, clarity becomes a sin. And the reason is because if we're confused, then we have freedom to play on the edges because everything's fuzzy. There are no bright lines. There's no judgment in that kind of a situation because who knows if you're outside or inside the lines because there are no lines. And that allows us this complete autonomy to do whatever we want as opposed to conforming our lives to reality itself.
Yeah, in your book, actually, you wrote that the current climate in which people are forcibly prevented from sharing ideas has arisen because we have mistaken autonomy for freedom. Can you just tease that out? Particularly, I think of the listeners that are experiencing those sorts of conversations or are afraid to share their ideas in today's culture. Could you just share? Do you speak into that?
Yeah, sure. And it's a terrible irony, actually, when we think about our quest for autonomy has actually led to slavery. When we think about what autonomy means, in common parlance, we mean freedom. But the word autonomy doesn't actually mean freedom. And Oz Guinness has so astutely pointed out that you can judge the health of a culture based on how it treats its chief virtues. And its chief virtue in the West is freedom. We hear about this all the time. Our most important and most powerful movies are about winning freedom and all these things. Autonomy and freedom aren't the same thing. So autonomy comes from two Greek words, autos meaning self and nomos meaning law. So when you're autonomous, you are basically a law unto yourself. And then I'm a law unto myself, and another person is a law unto themselves. Well, think about the chaos that this brings. If I'm a law unto myself, and my preferences matter more than truth, and someone else is a law unto themselves, and their preferences matter more than truth, and my preferences and their preferences happen to be in conflict with each other. When we meet in the marketplace of ideas, we used to have a civil public square where you could civilly discuss these things because we recognized we were trying to get at the truth. and the truth was our arbiter. But we no longer have a civil public square because preferences matter more than truth, and I'm autonomous, and so is somebody else. So now it's not a public square. It's actually the sands of the Colosseum. It's actually a gladiatorial match. So who will win if truth isn't the determiner of who's right and wrong? It won't be truth that determines right and wrong. It'll be power. And what ends up happening is certain views get stifled because they're not in line with the current cultural preferences. And how do we know what those are? Just ask the people with the biggest microphones or the most guns. They're the ones with the most power. They're the ones who determine what is culturally preferential, and everyone else has to shut up and be quiet. And that's not freedom-inducing. That's actually freedom-oppressing. So isn't it ironic that autonomy leads to the enslavement of people? I would even say the enslavement's a bit of a strong word, but what I would say is it leads to the repression and the oppression of certain viewpoints. So people become afraid to say what they want to say. Whereas a truly free society, you shouldn't be afraid because truth is not something to be feared. But autonomy and freedom aren't the same thing. Autonomy leads to chaos and then eventually oppression.
You know, Abdu, first, you know, I wanted to thank you for writing this book. It's a fantastic book and clearly the right time for a book like this that people are trying to navigate through a post-truth culture. And I think you would appreciate this, that there is, as we're talking about here with power, that this is a question of authority. It's a question of power. And in particular, you see this just even in the individual, that the individual has complete autonomy, right? I mean, has complete authority. And one of the things that we're seeing that I think is very fascinating is from the Enlightenment, we saw a shift of power from theology to science. And I'm seeing a new shift of power from science to law. Because ultimately, when you talk about this gladiator match, right? I mean, it's who has the microphone. Yeah, but ultimately, what we're seeing often take place is that microphone really is becoming laws that are being passed such that the research that's being done is, you know, science doesn't have the footing that it once had in our culture. And I think it's interesting, you bring this up in your book as well. Just even the fact that truth is being lost in the scientific community with regards to the, you know, different scientific research and whether or not it's reproducible and what sort of standards are happening there. And particularly, I think we haven't thought through what capitalism does to science as well with regards to who's going to get grants and how funding is going to be distributed. One of the things that I'm seeing then here is that and I'm wondering your perspective, particularly from your perspective in law, we're seeing the legal system being used as a wing of power for ideas. And then if you could speak to that, and also I'd like to talk more about this idea of science and what's happening with science in the midst of this post-truth culture.
Sure. And these are actually interestingly related, actually, as you pointed out. So the rule of law essentially is, when you hear about Western society, we're not a rule, we're not governed by might makes right. We're governed by the rule of law, the consent of the governed, as it were, to say these are the fundamental rights, and every law that is enacted based on our constitutions and our charters is based on certain fundamental issues that we think are almost like natural law. They are, you know, we're endowed by our creator, as it were, or these are God-given or inalienable rights. And every other law after that is based on the truth of those inalienable rights. Well, that's not what's happening anymore. They're not based on the truth of certain fundamental rights, what it means to be human or what it means to be under God. They're now based on what it means to have my preferences fully met and certain people. And if I don't agree with your preferences, I'm going to be forced to agree with someone else's preferences under law. So yeah, what ends up happening is ironically, this is the incredible irony. Folks like Locke and Rousseau and Hobbes and John Stuart Mill and all these folks were constantly thinking of ways to get us out of the state of nature. That's what the whole legal enterprise was about, getting us out of the state of nature where might makes right, the strong kill the weak, and into the rule of law, into the state of civilization where we have this consent of the governed based on whether it's social contract or covenantalism, whatever it might be. Well, we're back now into the law of the jungle, but instead of teeth and claws, now we have statutes and laws that are used to have might make right, because it's not based on fundamental rights anymore and the truth of what it means to be human. It's based solely on preferences. And this applies antithetical even sometimes to the science itself. When we have well-established science that shows us that certain behaviors and giving vent to certain things actually results not in human flourishing, but in human detriment. There's actually damage that's being done to people. But look, the fact of the matter is we're going to ignore that because even though that's factual and it's truth, we will have our preferences to think about and our personal feelings to think about, and we're going to eschew those things because if the science conforms with our preferences, then suddenly it's valid. But if it disconfirms our preferences, well, we ignore it altogether and we make laws to overcome it.
Have you not just been incredibly frustrated by this? To me, I think the irony of that, or not even the irony, just the patheticness of it, where you've got the scientific community that is quite willing to take religion to task at any and all cost. Yet they're in this post-truth culture where science itself is being undermined, and they are quite happy to just jump in that stream and head with it. I've often thought, you know, why is the scientific community not rallying against this post-truth culture? And in particular, how it's undermined science these last couple of years. I mean, The Economist and others have written numerous articles lambasting a lot of the research that's being done currently. And there's all you even mentioned an article from Nature, how bad it's gotten. What do you think's going on there as you're doing your research, Abdu? Like, what's your thoughts with regards to this?
Well, there are actually, I think, three facets to it. The one facet is that the article you referenced that I actually referenced from Nature and from Smithsonian Magazine, there's a study done on scientific studies about whether or not studies that were published as scientific fact or established findings in our most prestigious journals, whether those findings could be reproduced. And of course, the sad reality was that 40%, less than half, of the findings could be reproduced depending upon the certain discipline of science you're looking at, which of course shows us a couple of things. The question is why? And one of the reasons is because of the pressure to publish and the pressure to have, you know, sort of sexy headline grabbing findings as opposed to, oh, I spent grant money on reproducibility studies, which is good science, but we don't want to do that. We want to have headline grabbing things. But also I think that there's that preference that trumps the truth. The other thing, though, I think is there's actually a social pressure, and I can't get in the mind of every single scientist. I wouldn't dare to. However, I do think that the social pressure to make sure that our studies conform to the prevailing views of the time, and that those studies better conform or else we're not going to fund you anymore. So make sure your studies conform.
Oh, I was just going to say one of the things I see as well when I go to academic gatherings or look at different organizations, you'll often see that they'll publish right on the front of their website. Listen, if you're willing to study in these areas and you're kind of hinting and you're willing to come to these sorts of conclusions, there's plenty of funding for your PhD studies.
Yeah, and that's a frightening thing because that is basically rigging the facts to fit my feelings, not the other way around. And we'll actually do it, and we'll have letters after your name to sort of give you the imprimatur of credibility in doing this. I think, though, the good news is that the careful researcher can find those integrous scientists and grant writers who are willing to say, I want to go where facts are, not where preferences lie. So, for example, there are plenty of studies that show the negative effects of certain kinds of behaviors or whether or not sex reassignment surgery actually helps people or if it just leaves them in a state that's just as bad or maybe even worse as they were before. If they were gender dysphoric, for example, there's plenty of these things as well. Now, what's interesting is that you have people like Michael Shermer, for example, who have written some things. So there are voices rising up outside the conservative Christian ranks who are saying, wait a minute, this is becoming a problem. We better wake up to it. Because Michael Shermer had written an article, I believe, either in New Yorker or in another magazine, and I quote it in the book, where he points out that this thinking is actually getting people of every stripe disinvited, not based on their positions generally. So atheists can, you know, rail against Christianity all they want, but the moment they pick out another religion that might be a minority in that country, they're disinvited. And they're even considered bigoted or phobic of whatever view they have. well, wait a minute, they could chastise Christianity all they want or a certain other view or political view, but the minute they go against the prevailing preferential view, well, then they're bigoted and they get disinvited.
It's interesting on that note, Abdu, I just received a letter in the mail yesterday from a young man that I've had the privilege of mentoring over the years, who's in the U.S. military. He's in the Marines as an officer. And he actually in his letter wrote to me and just said, it's interesting, he said, the sort of foul language that can be used in the military with Jesus's name attached to it. And I was thinking about that, you know, it's that whole thing, right? You can use curse words that have Jesus's name in it, but you better not do that with Muhammad's name, right? Or one of the other different religions. It's an interesting aspect of this post-truth culture where certain things are available to you to lambaste all you'd like, but other things have become sacred in this.
Yeah. And you know, there's one other thing, though, an aspect of this that I've been thinking about this, and frankly, ever since my law school days, I remember thinking about some of these cases where they had to have, like, you know, creches or nativity scenes taken down from public lands and all this. And sometimes the Supreme Court justices of the United States would talk about why that was. And I remember thinking to myself, does this apply to every single view? If you had other religious views displayed, would you have the same sort of reaction to these things? And this is before I was even a Christian. And I've since thought about these things a little more. And yes, while there seems to be a double standard, I think there's two reasons. One, in the West, we tend to like the underdog. In fact, the United States and Canada were essentially underdog nations, and they've always been until recently. The United States, for example, won its independence from the biggest and most powerful empire in the history of the world at that time, and it was a bunch of guys with muskets who did it. So we tend to like the underdog. And whenever somebody becomes too big, we sort of like wish they were like the Rocky, you know, and we want the smaller guy to beat the bigger guy, not realizing that we've become the bigger guy. And then maybe we sort of have this sort of self-loathing. I'm not sure if that's what's happening either. But here's the thing that I think is important for us to keep in mind, as Christians especially. The reason why I think the Christian worldview becomes subject to criticism is almost, it's like a left-handed compliment. Everything else is so fragile that we can't even whisper at it, because if we whisper at it, it'll shatter into a million pieces. But the Christian faith has shown itself demonstrably over 2,000 years to be able to take the hardest blows society can throw at it, whether it's the Roman Empire, or it's the higher critics of the German scholarship, or it's the Bart Ehrmans of the world, or it's the social critics today that equate evangelicalism with Nazism. Whatever it might be, the Christian faith tends to stand up to this stuff and able to withstand it. So I think one thing we can do, yes, we have to work against that kind of a thing, but I think as a Christian, you can take heart, is to realize that even the culture, in a sort of backhanded way, recognizes the robustness of the Christian faith, that we can make fun of it, and yet it's still here, and it's still standing. And in so many parts of the world, it's not only standing, it's actually growing.
So moving forward in this post-truth mindset, you talk about this in your book. What do you feel are the negative consequences of losing our bearings on truth? And, you know, how is this going to affect the apologetics, you know, how we move forward with apologetics?
That's a great question. So I think the first thing to point out is that in order to deal with a post-truth culture, when you think about it, like I said, you could argue with a post-modern person, but with a post-truth person who says truth exists and I don't care, sort of left flat-footed and say, well, how do I argue with someone who doesn't care about truth? And that leaves an apologist sort of at a loss for words. Like, I have all these arguments and all this evidence, yet you're telling me you don't care. Now what do I do? It's almost like a conversation stopper. It just shuts it right down. Well, the reality is you can continue on with the conversation if we understand those consequences you just referenced. We're now engaged in a very pragmatic society where if preferences and feelings matter more than truth, then the feelings about the way things are going and where they're headed could actually really give us a foothold to discuss the negative consequences of post-truth. So we sacrifice clarity on the altar of our autonomy. And what ends up happening is three things. The first thing is we lose our sense of reason and our sense of wisdom. We lose it completely, because our preferences matter more. And I can give examples of this. One guy, for example, wanted to tell me that because all of us have incomplete versions of the truth, we have no right to disagree with anybody because our version of the truth is incomplete, and we have no right to disagree with somebody who has an incomplete version of the truth as well. And I said, of course we have that right. And he says, no, we don't. And I said, yes, we do. He said, no, we don't. And I said, you just disagree with me over this whole thing. Bit of a setup, but it's true. So otherwise intelligent people are losing their sense of reason. The second thing, though, is that we lose our sense of accountability. If we're autonomous creatures and our preferences matter more, then like Protagoras said so long ago, we are the measure of all things. And then how dare someone come against my autonomy? But if that's the case and we have no accountability, then I have also the third consequence, which means that I have no sense of human value anymore. People are valuable only in that they give me my ability to express my preferences to the extent that I want them expressed. So what's interesting is that it isn't preferences that matter. It's just my preferences that matter. Who's me? The one who happens to be in power, writing the laws or making the speeches, whatever it might be. So those three consequences, lack of reason, lack of accountability, and lack of human value, are what we can show people is what happens. Once they see that and they see the chaos that results, then the need for clarity and truth becomes evident. And that's when the apologist can step in and say, now that I've shown the need for these kind of things, can I show you where clarity actually leads? And it leads to hope, not just truth in a naked, raw sort of Mr. Spock kind of a way, but truth that's imbued with hope. And I think then we can actually engage in the apologetic endeavor that reaches the heart of the mind.
When I talk with fellow Christians about this subject matter, and as I've spoken in different conferences and churches, one of the things that I have seen over and over again is that Christians, by and large, have a difficult time juxtaposing, two things. One in particular is disagreeing with somebody, and on the other hand, loving them. And that you can both deeply disagree with somebody and you can deeply love them at the same time. And that ultimately it seems, to me that evangelism is going to have to come out of that. The problem, though, I see in a post-truth culture is that for a lot of Christians, the idea of loving a person is trumping the truth part of it. And this idea that they would rather, for the sake of unity, just embrace, hold hands or whatever, sing kumbaya, but give up on the truth aspect of it.
Yeah, and I've actually written an entire chapter in the book on the idea of the churches succumbing to a post-truth culture based on its preferences to either A, be liked, or B, vilify people. So we either A, want to be liked, and so we'll compromise on certain things, because we do want to speak the truth in love. So the question is, do we balance truth and love, or do we give them just truth and nail them over the head with stuff that sort of denigrates their worldview and shows the Christian faith to be true and feel like wonderfully triumphant that we won an argument? Or do we have this sense of love where we're not interested in winning arguments at all? What we're interested in is just having people like us. Both of those two extremes end up, I think, in a bad spot, as opposed to not just the truth or love, but speaking the truth in love. And I've heard you, Andy, on Q&As before, where I think you've marvelously done a great job of expressing both those things. It's important for us to do that. So the church, for example, in wanting to be liked, takes something like Matthew chapter 7, where Jesus says, do not judge for the same judgment you use, you'll be judged by as well, and say, well, we're not called to judge anybody. We're just called to accept and love everybody and not do the hard work of trying to interpret passages like things that put bounds on sexuality and marriage or certain moralities, or say that Jesus is the only way, or reference even difficult passages like the Canaanite judgments and all these things. We don't want to go there, because what we'll do is we'll reinterpret all of that to make it palatable to everyone without doing the hard work of actually trying to make it not only palatable, but actually say, okay, we're going to deal with hard stuff and we're going to talk about the truth, and some things are difficult. Well, Jesus does not say don't judge. Jesus says don't judge hypocritically. And so before we can get the post-truth speck out of the culture's eye, we ought to get the post-truth speck out of our log, out of our own eye as a church. But the pendular swing goes the other way too, doesn't it? Where we don't just want to be liked. Oftentimes we want to be right. And what ends up happening there is we're willing to bludgeon people with the truth as opposed to offering them the truth. But sometimes, it's a sad reality, the church, people inside the church have spread things and have spoken about things that I think just aren't true, or at least are vaguely true or unverifiable, in order to make the opposing side, the non-Christian side or the non-conservative side, look as bad as possible. And both of those things, are equally bad. Christians are called to a higher standard. And yes, it is hard work and it's often slower. Truth is always slower than a lie, but the truth is always worth it. So we need to do that.
Amen, brother.
Well, we have probably quite a few more questions for you, but we've come to the end of the podcast. Thank you so much, Abdu, for being on our podcast today.
Well, thanks for what you guys do at Apologetics Canada. I'm a big fan of what you guys do. Always loved working with you guys. Thanks for the time to discuss Saving Truth. It's been an honor.
I think everybody needs to go out and pick up this book. Absolutely. It's very timely, and it's a great book. And thank you for your work that you do at RZIM as well.
My pleasure.
Yeah, we love you guys. We love working with you guys. We pray for you. Man, you know, it's awesome having a great ministry like RZIM and you guys out there that we can work with and just encourage. And man, my prayer is that we would just continue to see more and more organizations and people engaging with these important topics.
Thanks again, guys, for all you guys are doing too. And I appreciate the prayers and support. I'll be seeing Robbie tomorrow, and I'll make sure to pass that along to him as well.
Great. Thank you for joining us, listeners. The Apologetics Canada podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll be back next week with more things to think about. Woo! Woo!